back in November 2008, when just after President Obama had been elected, there was a great deal of euphoria among people who care about the situation in Palestine, who thought that his election heralded the possibility of great change in the situation in Palestine in particular, but in U.S. foreign policy more generally. And at the time, though, I wasn't one of those who shared that sense of euphoria and optimism, even in a muted way. And what I wrote at the time was that President-elect Barack Obama's election victory has revived hopes that stalled Palestinian-Israeli peace negotiations could finally lead to a two-state solution. Few new presidents have been greeted with such optimism and associated high expectations. However, the chances for progress depend on more than a new American president. There are several interrelated factors: U.S. engagement, the availability of a viable peace agreement, Israeli and Palestinian internal politics, and the broader international situation. An examination of these factors indicates that the optimism is unjustified and that President Obama will not be more successful in bringing about a two-state solution to the conflict. This does not, however, mean that the situation will remain static or that those pursuing a just peace have no recourse for action. And in this particular article, I went on to explain a couple of things that I'll only summarize, but which I think are relevant for this evening's discussion. One is that when we talk about U.S. engagement, on the whole, people mean, has the United States appointed an envoy? And is that envoy to-ing and fro-ing between various capitals? And is whoever happens to be Secretary of State making statements about how seriously the U.S. takes this issue? But what I argued is that we really have to look at the full range of U.S. engagement that is usually not talked about. Aaron David Miller, a former top State Department official, succinctly summed up the American role in Arab-Israeli diplomacy over the past 30-odd years in a Washington Post op-ed in 2005. As Israel's attorney, catering and coordinating with the Israelis at the expense of successful peace negotiations. And I'd argue that the United States is still acting as Israel's attorney, now increasingly a criminal defense attorney in the face of mounting evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Bush administration really took American engagement to new levels. There were, of course, things like the long-forgotten Annapolis conference when 67-odd countries were invited to Annapolis, Maryland in I think 2007. I can't remember exactly. So 67 governments were invited, except for the one that Palestinians had at that point recently elected in the occupied territories. But what was more important, I think, was the Bush administration's direct intervention in Palestinian internal politics. First, the Bush administration pushed for elections in the occupied territories, and then when Hamas won them, attempted to overthrow the result by sponsoring a coup. And this was really well documented in a number of places, but one article in particular that I would refer to you by David Rose in the April 2008 issue of Vanity Fair called The Gaza Bombshell, which really laid out this sort of Contra-like intervention to try to overthrow Hamas. the administration helped arm and train Palestinian militias, again similar to the Contras, whose goal was to overthrow Hamas. It vetoed a Palestinian national unity government, and crucially, it supported the blockade of Gaza that began as soon as Hamas was elected and was tightened in June 2007 when Hamas countered the American-sponsored coup, and which has been maintained since the Israeli bombing of Gaza just over a year ago. So this U.S. engagement is often not talked about, but it's been terribly destructive. You have to also count other forms of U.S. engagement, the billions of dollars a year in military aid that is sent to Israel, the lethal weapons, the close intelligence and military and other forms of cooperation that sustain and fuel the conflict, and in fact an intervention on one side. What I wrote back in November 2008 was that for the Obama administration to live up to the expectations and break with its predecessors would require that the U.S. make financial and other aid to Israel conditional on compliance with international law and signed agreements, such as long-ignored UN resolutions requiring Israel to cease building settlements and, in fact, to dismantle settlements, to stop interfering in Palestinian internal affairs and respect the democratic choices of the Palestinian people, and call for an immediate end to the blockade of the Gaza Strip. It would also require that the United States exercise its influence to level the power imbalance in negotiations rather than weighing the scales even further toward the stronger side. This includes using consistent standards for judging violent acts, negotiating ceasefires, and apportioning responsibility for breaches of ceasefires by Israelis and Palestinians. Now, with the perspective of more than a year of the Obama administration, I think we can safely assess the scorecard. You'll recall that the Obama administration made a demand, just as I had advised, although I have no illusion that they know I exist, let alone listen to what I might say, but demanding that Israel halt the construction of settlements in the parts of Palestine Israel occupied in 1967. And we saw how quickly, in the face of Israeli intransigence and the mobilization of the Israel lobby, the Obama administration completely dropped this demand in a really humiliating and quite blatant way. The Obama administration did not stop interfering in Palestinian internal affairs and has shown no signs of respecting the democratic choices of the Palestinian people. On the contrary, the Obama administration escalated the program led by Lieutenant General Keith Dayton to train Palestinian militias loyal to the U.S.-backed Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, and urge them to go out and hunt down and kill and arrest members of Hamas. They've shut down hundreds of civil society organizations in the West Bank. In other words, to sponsor a low-level Palestinian civil war and to block intra-Palestinian reconciliation. And finally, we've seen no word whatsoever from the Obama administration to commit to pressuring Israel to lift the siege and blockade of Gaza. In fact, not one word of criticism has emanated from this White House about the atrocities committed in Gaza. And the blockade continues really not just with the acquiescence of the Obama administration, but with its full support. I also went to Cairo for the Gaza Freedom March. And when Egypt decided to block us from proceeding to Gaza, more than 1,400 people from over 40 countries. Our buses were prevented from going. They allowed a small token delegation to go, but the vast majority of us were not allowed to go to Gaza. We went, several dozen of us, several dozen Americans. This was, of course, a multinational group. But we went to visit the United States Embassy to ask our government to assist us. We wanted to tell them that it was in Cairo in June that President Obama had come to announce his new beginning with the Muslim world, and it was from a podium in Cairo that he had lauded the nonviolent tactics of the civil rights movement as examples for Palestinians and others to follow. So we wanted to go and tell the United States Embassy that we had come to Cairo in that spirit, and that we wanted them to assist us to go to Gaza, where the people were waiting for us, so that we could walk with them, next to them, in solidarity, commemorating 1 year since the Israeli massacres. We were in fact detained outside the Israeli embassy for about 6 hours. About 30 of us were in one enclosure, completely surrounded by Egyptian riot police and intelligence and metal barricades, and another group of seven in a similar situation a few dozen yards away. These enclosures came to be called the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And we were held there with the full knowledge and acquiescence of the U.S. Embassy. Our right to visit our embassy was denied until finally three of us were allowed in. I was one of the three. And we went on condition that nobody there, we weren't going instead of the others, we were simply going as the first group, and our demand was that anyone who wanted to visit the embassy be allowed to do so. We spent about an hour having a discussion with the chief political officer in the embassy, and we talked a lot about what was going on in Gaza. And they told us, well, we don't want you to go because we're afraid for your safety. We said, well, we understand the risk in going to Gaza, and we appreciate your concern, but we understand that the greatest danger to human life in Gaza is from weapons supplied to Israel by the United States. And we also recognize that, as you've said, they told us, don't you know Americans have been killed in Gaza? We said, yes, we're aware that Rachel Corrie died in Gaza. And if we had heard the United States government hold Israel accountable for Rachel Corrie's death, as well as the deaths of thousands of innocent Palestinians, we would perhaps be more impressed by your concern. But what we learned there was that not only was the U.S. government going to do nothing to facilitate our passage to Gaza, more importantly, they were actually actively aiding the tightening of the siege and blockade, that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, instead of rebuilding the levees in New Orleans, is helping Egypt to build, in fact, really directing and supervising Egypt to build an underground barrier that is designed to prevent people in Gaza digging tunnels, which have become their only lifeline for many basic necessities.
You're listening to Ali Abu Nima speaking Friday, March 5th, 2010, in Portland.
So this is the complicity of the United States, which continues entirely unchanged from the previous administration. One of the things, I don't want to spend too much time looking backwards, but I think it's important to really look at these issues with a lot of clarity and precision. Because I think one of the myths that circulated was, well, we don't know what Obama's policy is. We have to wait and see. There's a, you know, give him a chance. When in fact he had been very clear through the previous years of the campaign, and I made a list of the policy, the positions he'd taken, and these are all direct quotes from speeches he'd made, so they're not inferences, but some examples that are significant. He supported the Israeli bombing of Lebanon in July and August of 2006, and repeatedly in the Gaza Strip of as exercises of Israel's right to legitimate self-defense. He opposed the holding of the Palestinian elections, which included Hamas, in January 2006. He opposed the February 2007 Mecca agreement, in which Fatah and Hamas and other Palestinian factions agreed to establish a national unity government and to peacefully resolve internal Palestinian differences. He supports the continued isolation of Hamas. This is all prior to the election. He stated, "I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself in the United Nations and around the world," again indicating the continuation of the U.S. veto. He promised at least $30 billion of military aid to Israel over the next decade and pledged to push for Israel to gain access to armaments reserved for normally for NATO members. Pledged, "The U.S. should never seek to dictate what is best for the Israelis and their security interests." Stated, "Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel and it must remain undivided." Explicitly opposed the Palestinian refugees' right of return, and the quote from him was, "The right of return is something that is not an option in the literal sense." I'll say more about that later. And the list went on. What I concluded back in November was that there would in fact be no progress whatsoever towards a two-state solution, although we would see all sorts of kabuki about negotiations and envoys going to and fro. And in fact, we see that starting up again with George Mitchell starting so-called indirect talks. But what I did say is, and I think this is what brings us to the point we are now, is that while we can expect little change in U.S. policy just because a new administration takes office, this does not mean that U.S. policy will never change. The previous administration had to adapt its strategy to regional shifts of power, to resistance on the ground, and other developments beyond its control. And some of the factors that I think will continue, again, regardless of what the United States administration does, I suggested the following. There have been two Palestinian intifadas, uprisings against Israeli occupation in the past 20 years, and there are warnings of a third. Israel will find it increasingly difficult to justify its policies to global public opinion and will face a growing challenge from the international boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Efforts to pursue Israelis accused of war crimes in the occupied territories through universal jurisdiction will intensify and may begin to bear fruit. Palestinians in Gaza will refuse to remain besieged. Palestinian citizens of Israel will continue to their own struggle for democracy. And finally, I noted that with open discussion so constrained in official circles, the discourse is confined to this very stifling peace process industry discourse, which focuses only what men in suits do, and occasionally women in pantsuits, but usually men in suits, and ignores everything else that's happening. That as this official discourse continues to really become more and more separated from reality, This is also a moment when the growing number of academic and civil society conferences, debates, and activities aimed at exploring alternatives to the two-state solution can begin to decisively shape visions of a just, achievable, and peaceful future for all the people of the region. So that was my analysis in November 2008, and what I'm saying is I was right, so you should listen to me now.
This is a talk by Ali Abunima, recorded last Friday in Portland.
I think a moment that many of us saw coming, some of us resisted and others embraced, has now arrived. And that's the moment when people understand that the so-called two-state solution is really the two-state problem. That what was at the root of conflict in Palestine was indeed the very effort to create a separate entity for a colonizing people and to partition the country, that the conflict as it exists today is the result of the violent partition of Palestine and the attempt to cleanse it of its original people so that there could be a so-called Jewish state on a land which for centuries had had an overwhelming Arab majority of Muslims, Christians, and indeed indigenous Palestinian Jews, who though few in number, had a long presence and roots in the land. So now we see the collapse of this consensus. When I travel around college campuses, I find that the young generation are enthusiastic about a single state. They see in it a vision that chimes with their universalist values, with a sense of justice, that this provides justice for Palestinians, equality, and it provides Israeli Jews with the possibility to, for the first time, actually be accepted, but by exchanging their status as settlers and a privileged caste for status as citizens and acceptance in exchange for making restitution, for decolonization, and bringing justice. But I still face quite a lot of opposition to this idea. Some people will sometimes say that what's the point of talking about a one-state solution when the vast majority of Israeli Jews are absolutely against it. And Israeli President Shimon Peres said in November, anyone who rejects the two-state solution won't bring a one-state solution. They will instead bring about one war, not one state, a bloody war with no end. And there are many other people who sometimes echo that view. And indeed, across the political spectrum, Israeli Jews insist on maintaining a separate Jewish majority state. But given the collapse of any viable alternative, I think we have to look at alternatives and consider how feasible they are. And I've argued, and certainly not uniquely, this is something that is seen increasingly. And in fact, I explored this. I borrowed a copy of my book to show you because I was very surprised, pleased to learn that there was a sudden surge in demand for it. It hadn't been a runaway bestseller. It was doing okay. But as we were planning this tour and we contacted the publisher, they told us it's out of stock. And we're reprinting it, but unfortunately the reprints won't be ready in time. So I borrowed this copy just to show you, but it should be back in the stores any day now, or it's available from Amazon. But in the book, I won't go into all that now, but I explore the analogy with South Africa that I'll talk about from a different perspective this evening. Another example that I think is particularly important and has to be studied carefully and understood is what has happened in Northern Ireland, where there has been a a very similarly structured conflict which resulted from the settlement in the 17th century of the northern part of Ireland by English and Scottish settlers who were predominantly Protestant, and the violent displacement of the indigenous people who were predominantly Catholic. And this established a settler-native dynamic very similar to Palestine. And when Ireland was partitioned in 1921, it created Protestants in the north called, it was called Northern Ireland officially, but it was what they called unofficially a Protestant state for a Protestant people. And this meant that the native Catholic people living there were second-class citizens. They were living under a sort of apartheid state. And the peace agreement in Northern Ireland, which came after a good 300 years of this, a much older and deeper conflict, you could say, than the relatively young century-old one in Palestine, maintained the partition of Ireland. I mean, you could say that Ireland today is a two-state solution. It's a very different one from what has ever been contemplated in Palestine. You have the Republic of Ireland in the south, but in the north, you no longer have a Protestant state for a Protestant people. You have a binational state of all its citizens. And you have a formal power-sharing administration which guarantees that all communities exercise power and that there is no more Protestant state for a Protestant people. And it establishes the principle of consent as being fundamental. And this is something that we're all taught in civics class, that a government can only be legitimate if it has the consent of the people who live under it. So if one day 51% of the people in Northern Ireland vote to change its status, to abolish it and join a united Ireland, then the governments are obligated to make that happen. But in the meantime, you have a remarkable example of a power-sharing administration, which I was in Ireland. I spent about a year and a half there at around the time the power-sharing administration came into being. And until it happened, this was in about 2007, nobody believed it would happen, that you'd have the nationalist Sinn Féin in a power-sharing administration with the unionist DUP of Ian Paisley. And it's, in a sense, very much like trying to imagine a power-sharing government of Hamas and Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. I mean, that raises a chuckle, but that's how unlikely what happened in Northern Ireland was in that context. And certainly it hasn't been easy. But there in South Africa you have an example of a unitary state with one person, one vote, and in Northern Ireland an example of a binational state with a sort of a formal power sharing. And both of these were viable, workable solutions to conflicts that were based in colonial settlement and expulsion, domination, and disenfranchisement of a native people, very similar to Palestine. But again, we have this conundrum that Israeli Jews, by margins of 90%, absolutely refused to contemplate giving up a Jewish state. So, faced with this observation, I decided to go back and do some research into what South African whites... In 1994, as we know, white minority rule in South Africa came to a peaceful end, a negotiated end. And it was replaced, after a transitional period of power sharing, with a unitary democratic state, with a one-person, one-vote system. But before this happened, how likely was this outcome? Was there any significant constituency of whites prepared to contemplate it? And what if the African National Congress, the ANC, had only put forward political solutions that whites told pollsters they would accept? Well, when you actually look at the evidence from the time, until very close to the end of the apartheid regime, the vast majority of whites in South Africa, including many liberal critics of apartheid, rejected a one-person, one-vote system. And they predicted that any attempt to impose one would lead to a bloodbath. Very similar predictions to those that Shimon Peres made about a one-state solution in Palestine. As late as 1989, F.W. de Klerk, of course the last apartheid president, said a one-person, one-vote system would be the death knell for South Africa. And we can understand that white fears were motivated from both some reasonable and unreasonable concerns. A study in 1988 that was published in the Journal of Modern African Studies found that South African whites, by an overwhelming majority, feared that a loss of white rule and a transition to majority rule would not just mean a loss of political power and socioeconomic status, but it generated physical dread and fear of violence, total collapse, expulsion, and flight, the destruction of their society. And they could look to the example of the forced departure of almost 1 million white settlers in Algeria, 300,000 from Angola, and tens of thousands from Mozambique, as examples of what might happen to them, but on a much bigger and more catastrophic scale. So there was partly the reasonable fear of losing everything they knew. There was also a racial demonology which relied on the notion that Africans were inherently less civilized, more prone to violence, were incapable of democracy, and you heard arguments that were something like this, show us another democracy in Africa. The moment we give up power, South Africa will become another black dictatorship like all the others. And of course we hear Israelis make precisely the same claim about Arabs and Muslims. So the racial or culturalist element is very important to recognize and name for what it is. Even as whites understood, as the 1980s progressed, that apartheid couldn't last, they still resisted a one-person, one-vote system and hoped that there could be some kind of alternative. Of course, you'll remember the Bantustans, the attempt to create these sort of pseudo-independent black states that quite similar to the Palestinian Authority, although I think that they had more independence than the Palestinian Authority. And just to give you some examples, there's a few, but I will just go over two that were striking. In 1990, the year that Nelson Mandela was released from prison, a nationwide survey of Afrikaner whites found that just 2.2% were willing to accept a universal franchise with majority rule. Another survey from around the same time, 1988, of more than 400 white politicians, business leaders, clergy, media personalities, civil servants, and academics, in other words, the white elites, found that just 4.8% were prepared to accept a unitary state with a universal voting franchise. So you see that neither at the grassroots level nor at the top did whites appear close to embracing democracy and giving up their power. And there were also large majorities that considered a one-person, one-vote system to be unacceptable. And in fact, you also had, as you may remember, the white electorate in South Africa moving to the right at the time, just as we see the Israeli Jewish electorate lurching very rapidly towards the almost fascist right parties such as those of Avigdor Lieberman.
You're listening to Ali Abunima, the founder of the electronicintifada.org and the author of The One State Solution.
So in short, the vast majority of whites were simply unable to contemplate giving up power, even though they understood that their backs were against the wall. The ANC, however, knowing all this, insisted on a one-person, one-vote system with no white veto. And as the protests against the system grew, the strikes, the township uprisings, the international pressure, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, The Economist magazine observed in 1986 that many, quote, enlightened whites still fondly argue that a dramatic improvement in the quality of black life may take the revolutionary sting out of the black townships and persuade responsible blacks, that's in quotes, led by the emergent black middle class to accept some power-sharing formula. And this really strikes me as exactly like the Obama administration-sponsored and Netanyahu-sponsored economic peace in the West Bank. The idea that if you put in enough funding and have enough glitzy projects and have an ex-World Bank official and name him the Palestinian Prime Minister, that you can simply co-opt the Palestinian movement and take the sting out of the demand for an end to the colonization. And indeed, the ANC had a lot of advice from its friends abroad that it should be realistic, that it should understand that whites will never give up power, and trying to force them to do so would force them into the lager, they would circle the wagons, and they would prefer collective suicide to giving up. Very much, again, what we hear about Israeli Jews. Even Helen Suzman, who died recently, was one of the apartheid regime's consistent critics, said in 1987, this is what she predicted, "The Zimbabwe conflict took 15 years and cost 20,000 lives, and I can assure you that the South African transfer of power will take a good deal more than that, both in time and, I'm afraid, lives." And, of course, it was just a few years later that the regime ended without there was bloodshed, but not on the scale that was predicted, thankfully. And I think, again, The Economist was quite astute, and it predicted that the view that whites would prefer collective suicide was really a caricature. The vast majority of Afrikaners, it said, were no longer Bible-thumping Boers, Boers being the Afrikaner word for farmers that they adopted for themselves. They were, it said, part of a spoiled, affluent, suburban society whose economic pain threshold may prove to be rather low. And it concluded that if whites would not give up the apartheid system voluntarily, then it was perfectly reasonable for the anti-apartheid movement to bring them the rest of the way through what it termed coercion in the form of sanctions and other types of pressure. "The quicker the white tribe submits," the Economist said, "the better its chance of a bearable future in a black-ruled South Africa." Now, with hindsight, we know that the combination of internal resistance and international isolation did force whites to abandon political apartheid and accept majority rule. But it's important to note that the combined strength of the anti-apartheid movement never really threatened the physical integrity of the apartheid state. Again, going back to The Economist, at the height of the township uprisings in the states of emergency in 1985 and 86, it said, "So far there is no real physical threat to white power. So far there is little threat to white lives. The white state is mighty and well equipped. It has the capacity to repress the township revolts far more bloodily. The blacks have virtually no urban or rural guerrilla capacity, practically no guns, few safe havens within South Africa or without." And I should note, just as a footnote there, that those weapons were largely provided by Israel in violation of the international arms embargo. The entire South African Navy and Air Force were outfitted by Israel, and even the riot equipment used against blacks in the township was manufactured by a company in Kibbutz Beit Alpha in northern Israel near the Lebanon border. So this balance of power never changed, and you could write a similar equation today about the power of a massively armed and rather ruthless Israeli state whose capacity for violence was demonstrated most recently in Lebanon and in Gaza, and much more lightly armed Palestinian resistance that really have no prospect in the near or far future of equaling Israel on the battlefield. What did change, however, and what all this military white might, including nuclear weapons, were unable to prevent was the complete loss of legitimacy of the apartheid regime. Once any legitimacy was gone, whites lost the will to maintain a system that relied on increasing levels of violence and repression to maintain control, and which rendered them international pariahs. So as the cost of the status quo rose to unbearable levels because of the internal resistance and the external solidarity, they decided to make what they called a quantum leap and negotiate a peaceful way out of the dead end that apartheid had brought them to. And it all happened much more quickly, as I noted, and with considerably less violence than had been predicted. This moment, I think, is significant because it's a moment when more and more Israelis are recognizing that Zionism is suffering a similar terminal loss of legitimacy in the international community as a result of Israel's actions. Israel has always tried to present itself, particularly to the American public, as a liberal, Jewish, and democratic state, which is like us. But what more and more people are seeing is the reality of Israel as a militarized, I'm sorry I've been talking so much the past few days that I'm losing the ability to make my tongue do what it's supposed to do. More people are waking up to the reality of Israel as a militarized, ultra-nationalist, sectarian state that relies not on the consent of the governed, because Israel does govern all the Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and within Israel itself, but on escalating and frequent massacres to try to control them. Just a few days ago in Haaretz, they had a story boasting about the IDF's new heroes. These are 18 and 19-year-old young Israeli women who sit in front of video screens and direct remote-controlled machine guns at the Gaza Strip. So these horrifying technologies are what Israel is relying on in order to maintain control to keep the unwanted humans, the people who are from the wrong ethnic group, in the prison that is the Gaza Strip, and to prevent them from being able to return to their homes in what is now Israel.
You're listening to Ali Abu Nima on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM.
This loss of legitimacy, Israel has tried to disguise it with propaganda, with trying to tell a narrative of a liberal state that is yearning for peace, when in fact there is a reality of more and less extreme forms of apartheid between Gaza and the Galilee. And it becomes more and more difficult to disguise as the demographic balance shifts once more in favor of the Palestinians. The Palestinians are becoming, in 2010, an absolute majority in historic Palestine, just as they were prior to 1948. And recently you may have heard that Ehud Barak, the Israeli defense minister, speaking at a conference in Israel, said that a failure to make peace with the Palestinians — don't be fooled by the peace language from Barak, I'll go into that later if you want to — but a failure to get some sort of political settlement that legitimizes Israel would leave either a state with no Jewish majority or an apartheid regime. In other words, what we already have now, I would argue, is a Jewish minority regime ruling over a disenfranchised Palestinian majority. At this point, a very tiny majority, but the trend is very clear. That's not even counting the refugees outside the country, of course. The threat is taken very seriously by Israel, and just a few weeks ago, one of the most influential think tanks in Israel, called the Re'ut Institute, made a presentation to the Israeli cabinet of a report which warned that Israel's traditional strategic doctrine, that where it viewed the principal threats to its existence as military, was out of date. That the main threat Israel faced was not on the battlefield. The main threat was the threat of what they called delegitimization. So exactly what happened to apartheid South Africa. And the report warned that a global delegitimization network — it's rather paranoid language, but nevertheless I think indicative of the mindset — that a global delegitimization network sought to bring about the implosion of Israel, much as what happened to the apartheid regime or to East Germany or the Soviet Union. And that, rather than military defeat on the battlefield, was the greatest threat to Israel. This so-called delegitimization network is made up of the broad movement of peace and justice, human rights, and BDS activists all over the world. BDS is short for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. And its manifestations include things like Israeli Apartheid Week, which is this week, and which students at colleges all over the world are marking with events like this one and like the one we had at the University of Oregon earlier today. The use of the legal systems of various countries to try to bring Israeli war crime suspects to justice, the Re'ut Institute characterized as lawfare, a really bizarre word, where if you resort to the law, you are waging a kind of war, an illegitimate war on Israel. Normally we view resort to the law as a good thing. Israel views it as a bad thing in this context. And you may know that just a few months ago, for the first time in history, an arrest warrant was issued for an Israeli leader by a magistrate judge in London for Tzipi Livni, who was the foreign minister and one of the architects of the attack on Gaza. She was not arrested. She cancelled her trip to the UK just in time. But this was very significant, and I think a life-saving act by this judge, Because for the first time in history, now Israeli leaders know that they have to take their personal fate into account when they launch the orders to commit potential war crimes. And just a few days ago, Ayub Ganich, a former vice president of Bosnia, was arrested on arrival in London on an arrest warrant issued by Serbia, and for crimes allegedly committed in 1992 and 93. So this is an example that shows that there is no statute of limitations, that these allegations and crimes will haunt Israeli leaders for however long it takes, and that Palestinians are using legal systems with increasing determination. And they know it, and they can now no longer travel abroad with the confidence that they will not be arrested. But here is, I think, the crux of the Re'ut Institute's analysis. They said that this attack from the delegitimizers, of course, delegitimizers, you'll note, is a very derogatory word, but what they call delegitimization, I call working for peace, equality, and justice. They say that this attack from the delegitimizers, and I quote, possesses strategic significance and may develop into a comprehensive existential threat within a few years. A harbinger of such a threat would be the collapse of the two-state solution as an agreed framework for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the coalescence behind a one-state solution as a new alternative framework. So they take this very seriously. Of course, they confuse cause and effect. They think that Israel's status has eroded because the peace and justice activists have been so brilliantly effective at disseminating their message. And I think they have, but I don't think they can claim all the credit. So they think Israel is losing legitimacy because there is a growing movement. But there is a growing movement because of Israel's actions. Israel is delegitimizing itself. There has been an upsurge in support for BDS since the attacks on Lebanon and Gaza in particular. They talk about undermining the two-state solution as if a little book I could write or a few conferences here or there could convince the multi-billion dollar peace process industry to abandon its path. They don't mention that Israel has, since 1967, deliberately settled the West Bank in such a way as to make partition or repartition impossible. And today, there is really no prospect of removing the 500,000 settlers in the West Bank, at least not without what would likely be a very bloody war. And I should note that rather than suggest to the Israeli cabinet that Israel actually change its policies, the Re'ut Institute suggested they go on the attack and sabotage the delegitimizers. And I won't say more about that now, but it was particularly poor timing given they call on the intelligence agencies of Israel to focus on the hubs of delegitimization. This is the language they use. And the hubs they named were Madrid, London, Toronto, New York, and the San Francisco Bay Area. So they were issuing a report that the Israeli intelligence agencies should be engaging in sabotage against Americans, Canadians, and Europeans, engaging in constitutionally protected activities in their own countries. And they suggested this at just the time the Dubai assassination was exposed. So a particularly poor timing. And the other thing they suggested was better marketing for what they called brand Israel. The point I want to conclude with, a couple of points in closing, is that what was fundamental to bringing about the change in South Africa, and what is already demonstrably bringing about introspection in Israel, in the form at first of this sort of panic, but also we can actually see positive forms of introspection in Israel, is the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. That this movement is imposing a cost on Israel. It is raising the price of the status quo, and therefore it is a strategy and a technology to help bring about the conditions where we could see real peace, just peace. The BDS movement is based on a call issued by hundreds of Palestinian civil society organizations in 2005, which calls on us in global civil society to boycott Israel academically and culturally, according to specific guidelines that I can refer you to that are online, and economically, until such a time that the three basic forms of Israeli oppression against Palestinians end. The denial of the right of return on racist grounds, that Palestinians fail to be from the correct ethnic group. The forms of colonization and occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and an end to the apartheid faced by Palestinian citizens of Israel. Those are the three basic elements of any just outcome. And this call, as I said, is supported by the broad stream of Palestinian civil society. The other element, so the Economist talked about coercion to bring about a change among white South Africans. And BDS is a form of coercion, but it's a form of coercion that doesn't require a single Israeli child to skip a meal, that doesn't shed any blood, but nevertheless imposes a political, economic, and very importantly, moral cost on those who persist in injustice. But it's also not enough. I've argued, and what I've sought to do with my book and a little bit in my comments tonight, is to put forward a positive alternative. That we have to start engaging in the act of imagining the alternatives, I think, in the form of a single state, and to engage in serious study of models that exist out there. And I talked a bit about Northern Ireland and South Africa as examples, but there may be others. It's possible to do this while taking into account the legitimate fears Israeli Jews have in the process of giving up power, but without indulging racism or maintaining undue privilege. And that's something that I would like to stress is your role and our role as well. That if you believe that a just outcome can happen, you can also help to bring it about through supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign in your communities. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a talk by Ali Abunima, recorded Friday, March 5th, 2010, in Portland, Oregon. This talk is available on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.